I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, and welcome to the Since 71 podcast. My name's Tom Hussey, and I'm here with Catherine Paquette, Hannah Lichtenstein, and our special super guest, Kira McCormack. Did I just butcher it straight away?
No, you're fine.
Okay. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for being here. Disclaimer, we are recording this in four different countries over three different time zones. Thank you so much for being here. I appreciate you've spoken a lot more in recent days, despite being very vocal about, from Catherine pointing me to your blog, that you haven't, once you pressed go, everything was out there.
Yeah,
that, you went through, and that was historically with the Vancouver Whitecaps, I believe. Is that correct?
Yeah, and Canadian women's national team.
Okay, so what we wanted to do today, more so, was obviously touch on these areas, but also look a little bit more into what solutions that are already in place and what solutions need to be in place a lot quicker moving forwards. I will move
it's
on
funny,
to yourself.
I think all of us have probably experienced this situation where, because in our circles we're known as like knowledgeable about women's soccer, that are like friends, family, anybody that's seen the news, now we become the person they're asking about. And it's like, yeah, clearly we're all exhausted because we've talked about it so many times because we're that person in so many people's lives, and it's become mainstream news now.
I don't know how you two feel about it, but one of the things I found exhausting over the last week, especially like covering a lot of the stuff out of the NWSL, is that a lot of this has been known for years, but it's kind of all been projected forward in its own kind of football Me Too movement in like one big week of suddenly, in a way it is a positive thing, because suddenly there is actual interest and there's an actual light being shone upon what in many situations has existed for decades. Mm-hmm. But I agree with you, Hannah, like on the other side, like it is tiring, not just the last week, but in general, that these events seem to have a pattern that replicates themselves across different leagues, across different countries, with no actual coherent solution being put forward, and more reactions to what happens over and over and over.
Sorry to hijack your intro there, Tom.
No, I was just gonna say that I think Kira's here from Thailand right now, so like over the last week, are you happier that more people are finding their voice, as well as the reports that they are?
I think, yeah, absolutely. In the sense that, just from personal experience, I know the lightness that I felt after that. I didn't even realize the weight that I was carrying. So I think from that perspective, I think that was a really, good part of it, in the sense of, I watched the clip of Mona and Sinead on, I think the Today Show, and just honestly feeling so happy for them, like knowing what it's like to have something happen, have it not handled properly, just kind of been pushed out the door, and then have to sit in it for 6 years and have something that mattered, you know, it, like for them, it's like Catherine mentioned, it's the same pattern like over and over again. So a lot of it was really familiar, listening to what they had to say. But again, the positive is that I think it's good what's happening right now. I think I'm not surprised by any of it. And someone even said to me that they felt, it was a journalist like a month before this whole thing broke, said to me, you know, it's really weird in women's soccer how there's not been anything that's come forward. And I've always found that the sort of darkest secrets are found in the quietest places. So I couldn't help but think about that as these stories were coming forward. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's again, like I mentioned briefly before we started recording, that this isn't going to be isolated by any means, I feel, which is really sad, because me and one of the other hosts, Stu, are one of three male coaches for an under 16 girls football team. Mm-hmm. And I mean, they don't, and maybe some of them see it, but most of them aren't really interested in women's football as such in the grander scheme.
Well, Tom, I'm interested actually, because in thinking about the sort of like, how do we move forward conversation, one, you know, thing that's been coming to my head constantly is like, what sort of trainings and workshops are youth coaches getting? Are they just having to click through like sexual harassment slides that are like, don't invite a player to the room, you know, because there's so many, I think of that iceberg when we were having these conversations about racial justice. And, you know, the iceberg of like oppression or systemic justice, there's like the very top that's above the water. And that's like the stuff that, you know, you're not supposed to do as a coach, right? Like you most coaches know you're not supposed to do that stuff, but there's so much of that iceberg, you know, below the water. And I'm curious, you know, from your perspective as a youth coach, like, are there trainings being done? Like, are there, besides the X's and O's of what you need to learn to get a license or be qualified?
What is the safe in the UK, the FA safeguarding kind of covers parts of that. And there is, I've got a manual down there somewhere that has it all in, but then it's any of the quizzes, like any kind of 1 out of 20 question quiz, you know, so it is common sense. But that doesn't mean that things don't get missed.
Are there any background checks?
Yeah. We have a police check, a criminal record check, basically. Okay. Again, I don't know what that can really show if things are hidden in the right way. This sounds terrible. I'm saying things like this, but
it's true. Like, you know, the main story that kind of instigated everything that's come out in the last week is the story with Paul Riley and Manishim and Sinead Fairley coming forward and really speaking about their experience. And in his situation, like, you know, we're talking about mental coercion, sexual abuse. Is any of that, you know, being how difficult it is to actually prosecute sexual abuse, like, would any of that ever show up on a criminal record? You know, would any of that ever be prosecutable to the point that if he was not as known as he is and he showed up elsewhere, it would actually be brought to light? You know, this is a man who dealt with adults, but I don't think it's a far stretch to say that, you know, what is actually prosecutable and would show up in a police background is very different than what can be equally damaging to young girls, but won't end up ever seeing the light of day, like judiciously. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, 100%. There was the case, Mark Sampson, the former England coach, you know, it all came to light about the way he was speaking about Eni Aluko and some other players from African backgrounds, but England let him go because of apparently a former relationship he had with a player at Bristol, or that's what they said. So moving from one subject to another, they decided to get rid of him on that basis, and he's since worked in lower league men's roles but hasn't gone back to women's football as far as I'm aware. So that in that same boat, you know, some things are being looked at a bit more cautiously, I guess, but that wasn't their main focus, I feel, for trying to get rid of
it. I got like the E license in the US, which was like the very, very bottom of the coaching licenses you can get. And I was just thinking back and, you know, in the 2 to 3 days, like all we did was like on field stuff, concussion stuff, sure. But I just don't remember a lot of time spent on that. And I know that, you know, I really do think we're going to see reform and I'm holding out hope for that. But I think that it's going to start at like, just yeah, that level of like anybody that's going to be coaching girls soccer is going to need to go through some, I don't know, training.
I hope so. Yeah. I hope that these things come to a light.
I mean, I don't know if it's necessarily comparable, but if we're going across sports, like I'm a ski instructor and I've instructed children and adults for years. And I got my first actual training with regards to harassment 2 years ago. You know, but even there, like the background checks that we get are really not extensive. And there have been times that I've kind of wondered, because you do see, you know, you meet colleagues sometimes and you go, okay, these are people who are being literally given other people's children. And as a ski instructor, you know, I went on mountains that were like huge. I ski instructed in the West. I ski instructed out East. You know, you literally leave with these people's children and it always kind of, it was only until I actually got that training that I thought like, it's a bit absurd that this has never been part of my training in the past, being how much control I've had over kids that I might only know for an hour or I might know for an entire season. I don't think this is a problem that's isolated to football. I think how we properly train individuals who deal with both children and adults, and who are in positions of power with regarding to them actually playing or participating. I think we've only started scraping the tip of the iceberg of what needs to be done to ensure that they are properly trained for positions and they're properly monitored and background checked to make sure that people aren't put in abusive or children aren't put in dangerous situations.
Yeah. I mean, I think it was something in Lisa Devanna's article or one of the interviews said about how a lot of the terms of like, you know, that's just how it is and those kind of things that trickle down into other areas of the that youth setups per se and teams, just that these sort of things are kind of accepted.
The Devanna article, I actually reported on it, is a little bit difficult at this point to really go into the details. And first of all, like we have to believe victims that come forward. But what makes her article very different to the ones that were put forward by like Molly Hensley Clancy with the Washington Post and by like Megan Linhan and Katie Strang with The Athletic is that it's kind of, the abuse allegations are being fed by News Corp in Australia kind of in drips. So they put out one article yesterday where they kind of put these blanket accusations, and they only really gave one corroborative situation. So it's a bit more difficult to talk about Devanna's case, but I don't think it's a far stretch to say that cultures are built within sport and that if those cultures, you know, in the same way that we were just talking, if you don't have a background check or any training on how to deal in a position of power, how to deal with children, and a culture starts to emerge and you have players that do not feel comfortable in that culture, there's not necessarily avenues for them to come forward and express that. And that's one of the things that was within the original article, that she had felt that the culture that she was within was toxic, essentially.
You articulated what I meant to say about culture a lot better than I managed to get out of my mouth. I'm so sorry. But yeah, so moving forwards is obviously, we've sort of touched on this, that this is kind of the avenue we want to go for of how things can get better, training, access for players. I mean, is it the the NWSL Players Association has started out, I believe, a helpline to be as an outlet for anyone needing to talk or, you know, share or just get support now. And that's not the league or US soccer. That's the Players Association, because they are obviously on the ground. They're seeing what's happening as much as anyone else is, but anyone doing anything about it.
But you can't have the organizations be the group you're reporting to, because, again, just from sort of seeing how prevalent it's not like, you know, obviously this focuses on women's soccer this week, but it's gymnastics last week. It's like, even, you know, the abuse is like not limited to one country, one sport, one gender, whatever. It's the power dynamics. And I think the biggest problem across the board is that there's, to this point, I think athletes just show up to play. They're not thinking, I'm going to get abused or I'm going to be in an awful situation. And then you're in the situation and then you have nowhere to go. And I know the case even in Canada, and I've obviously become a lot more savvy to just being more aware of all these things, but like the whistleblower hotline, the last time that I checked. So like after everything that happened in our situation in 2020, if something happened to you, if you called the whistleblower hotline for Canada Soccer, the Legal Council of Ontario Soccer was the organization that was running that hotline. So I am literally, as somebody brave enough to step forward, calling a hotline that is run by a group that their mandate is to legally protect the organization. And again, unless you're in the space, you wouldn't be aware of that. But like the lack of integrity that is just like so prevalent through the whole system on the organizational side of it, because at the end of the day, they care about protecting themselves. They can have all the nice, you know, the whether it's the Olympic committee or whatever club team or whatever league, and it's all the players are so inspiring and all this kind of thing. At the end of the day, they're an entity. And if their employee is deemed a sexual predator or whatever, that's a lawsuit waiting to happen to them. And so they want to know the information so they can control the narrative and twist it. And that's a huge part of the problem with this. And this is why I think it's good to see the NWSL Players Association. They should be, you know, assuming that they have integrity and they're, you know, they're separate and independent and about protecting the players. Like that is the group that should be reported to, because the idea is that they're about protecting the players and not, you know, calling the hotline that North Carolina Courage set up, because it's basically just going to go into the organization who's probably going to cover it up, you know. And I think also we have to realize that when somebody calls and reports, they're already in such a traumatic state themselves. Do you know what I mean? Like it's hard enough to come forward. And I think that that's another part of it that I don't hear getting spoken about very often, but like victims, like Mona and Sinead had to like identify themselves, you know, as individual people, and all the vulnerability and all reliving the trauma and all those sorts of things. Whereas, you know, the Merritt Paulson and Gavin Wilkinson, unless you follow women's soccer, it's just the Portland Thorns fired Paul O'Reilly, and they can hide. They have the protection of the organization, but the victims have to stand on their own. And that's a hugely traumatic thing, even in and of itself. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think moving forward too, you mentioned those two names. There still is like rot that has not been cut out. So absolutely, that's like very, very, very short term. Needs to happen in order to move forward is there are still people mentioned in that story that, you know, need to be held accountable. So
I think like one of the issues that arose in the NWSL is that there weren't any anti-harassment rules in place until this year to actually protect the players. There was absolutely nothing in the player handbook until the players themselves, led by Alex Morgan, actually petitioned, you know, got together, petitioned to have that included. But one of the things that I find worrisome is there's two individuals that were let go this year. One, Elisa LaHue, which is the general manager of Gotham FC. And she was let go underneath these new anti-harassment policies, which she denies. And the other one, they don't specifically say it because it's anti-harassment, but it's Christy Holly, who's a man who was with the ex-head coach of Racing Louisville. But in both those situations, the anti-harassment policies keep the reasoning behind the firing confidential. And, you know, victims of abuse or harassment should be, you know, their names should not, and their stories should not, like, that should remain private. But if an employee, so a coach, a general manager, is fired underneath an anti-harassment policy in any company and any sport, any company in general, they should no longer have the privilege of having those reasons kept confidential. And the reason that it's, I believe that it's especially important in sport or when it comes to abuse, is that victims of abuse are very afraid of coming forward. And often it's because they feel like they are alone. And if you let somebody go who has harassed or abused somebody, but you never state the reason, there may be other victims out there that will never know that they are not alone. You will never truly be able to solve the problem of harassment if you don't get as much information about how this came about and covering up, even if you fire them and you say that it's for cause. And like when Christy Holly was fired, it was the first time the league had ever actually stipulated for cause, which for a coach, which is a big step. But the next step is they actually have to stipulate what that cause was. If that cause was because he was in fact fired because of abuse or harassment, because if not, you're just going to keep other incidences under wraps. You know, just my opinion, but it's a first step, but I don't think it goes far enough. We have to, other players, other staff, other potential employers have to know what happened. Yeah. I don't, if you've done this, you no longer have the right for that confidentiality as the abuser.
Well, and people say privacy, because I was saying this like the week after I came forward, that there needs to be some sort of registry that keeps track of those sorts of things. Like, you know, in the province that I grew up in Canada, in British Columbia, like there's a teacher's college. So like if a teacher gets fired for doing something, it's, you know, that's in their record in the teacher's college. And I think someone like kind of pushed back to me and was like, oh, well, privacy laws. But like, I think that, again, you know, just like a teacher has people in a vulnerable position and they have the power to abuse their position. Like, I think the second you take a role, whether it's a coach, whether minors, like whenever there's a power imbalance, I think you have to sign off on privacy. And I think that, you know, it's almost like we have vaccine passports in Canada now, like in BC where I'm from, like to go into restaurants, but it's almost like you need to have some kind of a safety passport to be able to work with vulnerable athletes and children. And that should just be a given. And I think to this point, you know, sometimes it almost feels like perpetrators built the system, because, you know, a lot of this stuff is kind of logical when you're looking at it, you know, like there's no way that coaches should be let go and have it be swept under the rug, like that opportunity even exists. So I think that, again, when you're thinking of solutions that could potentially put off somebody or make them think twice before they were going to abuse their power, like if they knew there was a potential that A, they're going to lose their job, and B, everyone's going to know why they lost their job. And they also know that the organization won't protect them because it's going to harm the organization and they're going to have to do something about it. Like, again, I think that that's another way to start getting this stuff under control, because without that, it's just everyone's, at the end of the day, like everyone's protecting themselves and they're always going to do that ahead of doing the right thing. If there's like one thing I've learned through all this.
One point that came up that is like related to what I've been thinking about in terms of moving forward, but has been difficult, I think, for me to think about as like a queer woman who knows how like queer woman soccer is and is like proud of that fact, is like there are abusers who are women, and I think we need to like expand our thinking to include that. And I know that that's coming up a little bit in relation to the Vanna stuff, and with potentially the Elise LaHue stuff. And it's hard because I have like some defensiveness around that. And I'm sure a lot of people have defensiveness around that. Like, you don't want to get into this like queer women are predators in the showers or something. But like, yeah, the language of abuser we need to have that image be more than just a man that looks a certain way, because that is how other people get away with abuse, because you have such an idea of what the abuser will look like. And it's more than that.
Yeah, locker room talk isn't just for men. It extends to women as well. And yeah, I mean, I understand where you're coming from. Like, you don't want to venture in. There may be a tendency for some to venture into an area that is, especially when we're talking about queer athletes, into a homophobic area. But we also have to be respectful that all athletes have to feel safe in every environment.
Well, and that abusers come in all shapes and forms as well.
Yeah. You know, this is a complete intersectional thing, you know, race, sexual orientation, gender, it doesn't matter. Everybody should feel safe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. 100%. So what more can we, as a group of people who aren't in positions of authority to make these changes, what can we suggest? What more can... Catherine's got a hand raised or pen raised. You've got a list of things ready to go, I'm assuming.
No, it's going to seem like a tangent at the beginning, but there is a point to this. You know, there are organizations that are that oversee sport, that oversee certain aspects of sport to keep its integrity. Specifically, the World Anti-Doping Agency, which was set up after the UNESCO International Convention Against Doping in Sport, operates independently of sport for the simple reason that they deemed there was a conflict of interest if sporting organizations themselves, who had been proven in the past, some of them, to cover up doping or even encourage it, to have them try to police this. The same goes with the U.S. Office of the UN Office of Drugs and Crimes with regards to sports. They have two resolutions that resolutions that were added, where they're allowed to take action with regards to corruption and match fixing. You know, again, this is put forward, and it is independent of national bodies, and it is put forward for the integrity of sport. I spoke to or I corresponded with Global Athlete Today, which is an athlete-led movement to try to promote promote athlete rights and to empower athletes to be equal partners. I spoke to corresponded with the Director General, Rob Kohler. And one of the things that he pointed out, which I think is important to add, is that all these athletes' rights violations are a direct breach of the UN Declaration of Human Rights and the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child. This is a primary reason we, as in Global Athlete, are pushing for the International Olympic Committee and international sport to embed the UN Declaration of Human Rights into the Olympic Charter and, by extension, the Paralympic Charter. You know, and this is an interesting one. Like, we have laws within sports that have been put forward to protect its integrity with regards to doping, with regards to corruption, with regards to match fixing, but we have yet to embed laws to truly protect athletes. And, you know, like Kira has shown, like, you know, we've seen incidences in gymnastics. Rugby Canada recently had a whole bunch of its players come forward with abuse. Now, these allegations with regards to the NWSL, that when they started was actually run underneath the guidance of UN Soccer. Like, you can go across a number of sports and find incidences of alleged abuse. And it is mind-boggling to me that we do not have an international agency that works separate from international bodies, but whose main reasoning for existence is to investigate and to prosecute abuses, whether they be verbal, sexual, any type of abuse within the sporting industry. You know, the World Anti-Doping Agency has the right to ban athletes. They did so with Samir Nasri for a year and a half. They also have the right to ban entire nations, which is why Russia hasn't competed again underneath its flag for, I think it's going to be the last Olympics and the next one. You know, the entire Russian Olympic Committee is currently banned and they have to participate. You know, so we have given other agencies the right to investigate, the right to monitor, and the right to actually act within this world of sports for the integrity. But we haven't even, there doesn't seem to be any discussion about creating an independent agency that is separate from bodies to protect athletes. And that to me is mind-boggling, but it is necessary. You know, again, like Kira showed, like so many people showed, governing bodies and national associations for sport have a direct conflict of interest when it comes. And the same goes for franchises, the same goes for clubs. There is a direct conflict of interest with when it comes to investigating allegations of abuse, because the person you're investigating might be your employee. The person you're investigating might even be the owner or yourself if you're the HR director. This isn't where we should be putting our hopes to try to solve this problem. I truly believe that we need a body that is independent to do it, because what we've seen time and time again is that what is in place at the moment is not only capable of trying to bring out and uproot abuse, but also is complicit time and time again and allows patterns of behavior that keep predators, that keep abusers in sports and hurt athletes time and time again across every sport, every gender, every intersectionality.
Can I say something?
Yeah.
So just along those lines, like I'm a big believer that if there's a solution, like an obvious solution to the problem and it hasn't been done, that there's usually a reason behind it. And so what, again, sitting deep into this space and sort of being a bit of an analytical thinker, trying to understand exactly everything that you're saying, you know, the biggest thing is, again, like, let's just use the World Doping Agency as an example. So if they find an athlete guilty of doping, that's not hurting the organization from a legal standpoint. If a coach is found to be abusing players, now the athlete has the legal potential to sue and win money from that organization. So that's the main reason why nothing has like been established, because why would you, if I'm a store, why would I set up, if I have, you know, I have full control and full power, why would I set up something that would make me potentially legally liable? So that's where, for me, like the next step in my thinking is that this is never going to happen. These things are never going to come from the organization. They're never going to set up there's no motivation for them to do it. So that's why, like, the more that I'm sitting in the space, the more that it's like the obvious solution is that athletes have to do it. And the other thing, again, talking about a funding like perspective from it, because the second that you even, let's just say with the safe sport in the US, it's funded by the Olympic Committee and by the government, and same thing. So again, for them to, you know, properly investigate, and let's say they pull up a whole bunch of creeps, well, now again, those athletes can sue the organization, and that's going to make it a precarious situation for them from a legal perspective and a financial perspective. So of course they're not going to do that. But like, as you were talking, actually just popped into my head, which I haven't thought about before, but like, if I'm playing soccer in Canada, I send $5 or $6 from my registration to Canada Soccer or to BC Soccer, whoever, to register. And I actually think when you're thinking about a funding perspective, like, I think it should be coming from the athletes. So maybe that's a potential solution as well, where like, instead of the $10 going to Canada Soccer, well, $2 goes into a safe sport organization that's set up as an entity outside of that, because the funding piece is the big problem, because everyone says, where's the money coming from? And that's, again, a good reason or a good way to sort of understand why the motivations behind, like, you're not going to piss off the person that's giving you the money, is basically. So I think, again, it needs to come from the athletes.
Yeah, I get what you mean, but you know, like the world, the original, like my understanding is what originally precipitated the World Anti-Doping Agency was certain associations kind of pressing for it to occur, but also because this was, proven to be quite to be part and parcel of a lot of sports, and it needing to be rooted out. And one of the good things that we're starting to see in the last couple of years is that a lot of this abuse is coming to light. So kind of the same patterns that led to the WADA or WADA, you know, may lead it. I'd also say that it has been detrimental to some national organizations, like the Russian Olympic Committee can't compete. You know, yes, their athletes are still there, but even when we go to match fixing, my understanding is there's people who've lost franchises and who've been banned because of match fixing that has been brought forward. So, you know, to go back to my communications with Global Athlete, like they talk about safe sport and they're like, the current safe sports structures are not fit for purpose. International leadership is required to right the wrongs for a safer environment for athletes. The status quo is failing. So we do that. There needs to be something in place that is independent of national bodies. Like, I get what you mean. It might be difficult to set up and the motivation might not be there, but it's needed because we're seeing this happen.
I agree. I never said it's not.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that the reason why the organizations haven't put anything together is that it's a financial motivation for them because it's essentially setting them up to get sued. I'm absolutely completely 125% in agreement that it needs to happen 100%. And
what I'm saying is that
it needs to be athlete led, not organization led.
Oh, no. This should be in no way led by the organizations. Like, there's a number that have shown that they are not competent to reacting to this, but also the organizations, franchises, clubs, they're the ones who run and who are obviously the most prone to this happening because this is within their, it has to be done outside of their kind of their control to be truly independent. But yeah, like these ideas that somehow the organizations and the leagues and the clubs that have where this has happened are ultimately the solution. I just don't see that happening because there needs to be an independence when it comes to true. So if athletes are truly going to feel comfortable to come forward and speak, there needs to be an independence. I don't think it's a surprise that a lot of this came forward because they chose to go outside of the actual sporting bodies and go to journalists and use the power of the media as a way to fight this, because where else could you go that is truly independent?
I'm going to put forth a potential solution from a different angle.
Okay.
Listener, you want to know what you can do to help change the culture and help put a stop to these horrific things that you've been reading. Go buy tickets and watch women's soccer. And I'm going to tell you why that's going to help. So, you know, obviously money talks, money makes the world go round. But, you know, as Kara's saying, like, if players are going to be best positioned and should be the ones advocating, you know, protecting their player, you know, their fellow players, which is quite the task, they shouldn't also be worried about coaching and doing all these side hustles and having to have bandwidth for, you know, having their career in soccer and then their four other careers and then also advocating, you know, for their teammates. Like, the more money that comes into the sport, the more, let's say, a player might be able to, you know, be in these advocacy like headspaces and like abilities. And also, so many people working in women's soccer work part-time. So many work part-time. And even, you know, you might be working that part-time job for all the good reasons and you want to be helpful, but it's still part-time. Like, it's not the thing paying the bills. And if you have a part-time HR coordinator, a part-time, you know, whoever's handling these important sort of, cases or bits of information that are coming in, and you're part-time, there's only so much you can do. Like, there's only so much you can give. And so I think that, you know, the more we start to infuse and can build, you know, money coming into the sport, that's like kind of indirectly going to be something that really, I don't know, is a great foundation for helping this sort of situation.
Yeah. Catherine and I spoke about it earlier in the week when we were trying to figure out the best way to approached this podcast, and once it was all, well, early in the week, last week even.
Sorry.
My Apple Watch decided to chime in with some information there as well that I didn't understand. and I sort of, one of my suggestions was, should we not just curtail the league now for the season? It's quite close to the end. Let's give the players some time to actually be out of the spotlight for a moment for any of that have come forwards or for any of that. And I said, no, we need to support them. And that is by them doing their job.
I mean, these poor players, they have to coach after practice and go to practice and do interviews. Like, it's just, there's so much, and there's no other athletes that are forced to like be spread in that sort of way. It's ridiculous.
And as much as one of my reasons for telling people about women's football is because of as much the players and their stories and their lives, for a lot of ways, are a lot more rich than any of their male counterparts for how they've either got to that place or what they're doing concurrently with their playing careers. And it, you know, and then this sort of supports that they need, you know, if this is their public eye. I'm losing my train of thought straight away. But to support these players in the right way, and they need, you know, we should all be doing that irregardless.
Well, it's also like important to point out that the sort of pattern that Coach Riley had was he was targeting those on the fringes. He was preying on the instability of the league. The fact that there were so many players were making $20,000 who could be cut at any instant, and like their livelihood was gone. And that's like an interesting part of this. It's because there's like no money in it.
But I think that's where like a player like Alex Morgan, like I have so much respect for her in terms of the fact that, you know, she was the one that pushed for the anti-harassment. She was the one that pushed for Mona and Sinead to come forward. And like, I, again, sort of living that environment and being a fringe player and seeing how little control you have, I think you need those players. Like, it shouldn't be a case. Like, Alex Morgan should be able to just play soccer and not have to be some behind the scenes warrior. But the reality is, again, when you're in these unstable situations, like someone like Alex Morgan does have capital, like social capital, financial capital, all the things. So I think that's, again, like I said, you hope women's soccer and sport in general gets to a point that everybody can just play the sport and not have to worry. But in these sorts of situations, like, I think it can't be understated how important somebody with capital, like an athlete with capital, steps up and advocates for other athletes. Because absolutely, the fact that like a Paul Riley would never have gone after an Alex Morgan because like there's, you know, he wouldn't stand a chance. But you go after a 21-year-old that's just come out of college and looking to break it into the pro league, or you know, which I think actually both players were like just fresh out of college when Paul Riley kind of came after them. So I think that part of it, again, like you need those players with capital in the situation. They can do whatever they want, but I think that's, it's just so impactful what Alex Morgan did. And I think it's a great example and something super positive out of the situation for sure.
I do hope that this does help any future athletes that need to speak up and have tried the avenues that are available for them and not gotten anything out of it. Because I do wonder if Alex Morgan isn't part of that story, if she's not on the couch beside Manisham for the Today interview, like, I'm sure the story would have come out, but would the story have had the same reach as it did, in the same way that, like, you know, the Devana article, you know, she's not the only athlete. So far, there have been two. There's been Raleigh Dobson, and today there was another article about Bronwyn Nutley, also having a feeling that they were in a specifically predatory environment and being subjected to stuff. And I'm wondering, like, if it's just those two players and you don't have the second highest capped, second highest goal scorer in Australian history who's been, like, kind of as, would this story have seen the light of day or seen traction? You know, because I don't want to keep pointing to you, Kira, but like the being Canadian and having seen these things happen a number of times in Canada, the part that's really worrying and saddening and disconcerting is that their voices aren't heard. You know, we know the allegations are there, and our media and just in general, the avenues that should be covering this and should be asking questions are not doing that.
Do you know why? Like what's, cause I obviously it's, you look at the US and there's all this investigative stuff. Like I'm just curious as like a fellow Canadian, if you have a theory on that. Cause I'm curious.
My theory is because we female athletes in Canada are disempowered to start off with, you know, that we don't have a female sporting culture here. Like one of the reasons that I'm a Canadian and that I cover the WSL and that my main job is covering sport in Australia is because, you know, they have professional basketball, professional Aussie rules. They have a NRL that's kind of getting there. They have professional cricket. They have professional soccer. Like they have professional netball. Like there's all these
point. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, there's all these, whereas in Canada, we have the Toronto Six who are semi-professional and the majority of the Toronto Six is an ice hockey team. It's the only women's team in Canada. I mean, there's the White Caps and there's a couple of WSL teams, but that is kind of even close to having something of a maybe professional status. And the reality is that league, the PEH, which used to be the NWHL, that league is boycotted by most of the best professional hockey players in the world because they don't believe it's professional enough. And they're actually trying to push for a league where they can have adequate playing conditions and adequate salaries to be able to survive. There's nothing here. So we don't talk about women's sports in our discourse. We don't really cover women's sports. Even though like the gold medal game and the last Olympics showed that there is a demand for it. It's just not pushed forward. I think it's because our country is big and the majority of our population is stuck on the American border. And so from a marketing and a cost perspective, it's a really hard country to cover. You know, Australia is quite similar, but it's isolated and it has a long history of its own sports, its own things. Whereas we have this behemoth that's the United States beside us, and it kind of like its voice often overtakes the Canadian voice.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, not to sound fucked up, but like as an American, like when I think of you guys, like culturally, like everyone, it's the jokes about how polite you are. Right. It's like, there's like a politeness. Like, I don't know if that's obviously coming from an outsider's perspective, but I'm like, America, what we're like the meth lab in the basement. Like we're constantly just like creating shit storms and, you know, rioting and protesting and I don't know.
Yeah. I think from a sports perspective though, it's like your male sports and which are largely integrated, there's a lot of franchises up here kind of they swallow up all the air in the room or most of the air in the room, as does hockey, male hockey. And there's really not a lot of space left. And there's just no history of covering women's sports. You know, we're talking like the NWSL has been around for 9 years. And I do wonder, again, if Alex Morgan isn't on that couch, does Manna Shim get interviewed by the Today Show? I really wonder that. And the reality is, I think the only player in Canada who could truly get the same thing is Christine Sinclair. You know, we just don't have a history of, and what I mean by that, I don't mean necessarily related to allegations of abuse. I just mean like actually getting airtime. We just
Christine Sinclair is like the best woman's, like she is the legend of all legends, but she's known as being just like the quiet leader. Right. I mean,
In our media, there's almost no, like there's, I worry about our national team when she departs because she's what most people identify with. And we want it to keep getting promoted. We want it to keep being able to be in the spotlight. And yeah, anyway, that's my really long-winded reasoning of we don't have a culture up here in Canada of talking or promoting women's sports. And there's actually no women's sports to report on here anyway. So
that's fair. That's a good point.
Yeah.
How American that I just tried to pretend like I was an expert on Canada. So American. Literally so American of me. Just bulldozing.
I mean, I've been to Canada. I have family there. I feel like there's quite a lot of women there as well. And I think most of them might have played sports in school or college. So the fact that there isn't as much of a professional outlet, like we spoke in the last one of the other podcasts about how most of them just head to America or to Europe or anywhere, other parts of the world to become professional athletes in so many areas.
There's really no, there's not as much stigma about playing and about competing here. I don't think we're as competitive, like just from an overt nature, maybe as the US are, but I'm aging myself, but I'm 37 and I played soccer growing up and there was no stigma attached to it. In the same way that I've talked to people in the UK and even in Europe and even in Australia. But at the same time, while there's no stigma to being an athlete, there's also no culture to actually promote it here. And so as a Canadian, that saddens me because we have a lot of really good athletes and they have to do something monumental, like win a gold medal to actually get some airtime and to get some recognition. But it also has a negative effect, which is, you know, we've had a number of national teams where female players have come forward and have stated allegations of abuse. And it's really gone nowhere in the media. And again, if the only person that you have to come forward and to report this abuse is the organization for which you are working for or are playing under, and you can't even rely on the media to try to bring your force forward, there's really nowhere, I can't think of anywhere else to go but to ultimately leave the sport. And that's my big worry for the majority of nations where women's voices are already deemed less and women's sports are in the same way as in Canada. It's just not a cultural thing to really talk about it, that this will just keep festering because there's nothing independent to oversee it. And that's one of the reasons that I'm kind of adamant about the other. I realize that it's probably unrealistic to have an independent agency, but it is one of the reasons.
No, I agree
that it's
with different. You. I feel like you misunderstood me, but like, I totally agree.
I did. Yeah. I absolutely did.
Yeah. No, yeah. I think it has to be independent, but yeah, 100%.
Yeah. So it's like, even I know this is, you can edit this out, Stuart, if you want, but like, this might be a tangent, but I used to work in the airline industry. I was a pilot, and there is a reason that when there is an accident, that it is not Transport Canada, which is our federal regulator, or our company that does the primary investigation. It's the National Transportation Safety Board. And this is the same in Europe, and it's the same in the United States. This is an independent agency that comes in, and the reason is to remove conflicts of interest. I would say that abuse and criminality in sport is akin to accidents or incidents in aviation. It needs to be done independently, and players need to have a place to go for to report this, that where they know that they will be, where they talk to people who are trained in how to take in the information, how to properly query the information, how to properly investigate the information, and where those players know that if they report this, there won't be any repercussions on them professionally, or, you know, if it's a semi-professional or whatever, that there won't be any repercussions on their playing career.
I have a lot of questions about you being a pilot now. You just casually dropped that into this situation. I have a lot of questions there, but we won't go into that now.
I want to look intelligent, so I try to avoid that topic.
Fair enough. And this is
that,
like,
was a pilot joke, by the way.
Pilots seem very intelligent. You have to fly that thing.
Anyway,
clear.
Yeah, we'll get back on the pilot talk at the end of the episode. We'll come back to pilot talk. With regards to the independent organization, there's a I think volunteer led, maybe even slightly funded led, and this is a departure from sports, but called Good Night Out. They help create safer spaces for nightclubs, for bars, for people who, for women and for men who have been under have received sexual harassment or drinks being spiked, things like this. And they are an independent organization and they do so, so much within their limited resources because of its, the important nature of it. So as much as obviously this is on a bigger scale and a much more important scale, it needs to happen. It needs to happen as soon as it can. I don't know what the, I mean, you know, you said about the UN leading these things, Catherine, with the, so I guess, was it the...
It's a UNESCO convention, and then the U.S. Office of Drug and Crimes has resolutions within its statutes that cover sport. And from there, you get the anti-corruption and the anti-match fishing abilities. And, you know, these are the important thing about the three abilities of those, of WADA, the agency, and the other ones is, one, they're independent, but they're also... I don't know if it's the proper term, but extrajudicial. So it doesn't really matter what the laws are in your country. These are the laws within sport that you have to respect. Because, you know, again, even within certain nations, the laws of what constitutes harassment, what constitutes abuse may vary from state to state, province to province, you know, jurisdiction to jurisdiction. So this is kind of like a standard, like this is what we've agreed, you know, and upon when it comes to doping, when it comes to match fixing, that you have to abide by. And the problem is that the moment in sport, from my understanding, speaking to Global Athlete, that like they haven't even adopted this within the IOC convention. So if you know you haven't included the Declaration of Human Rights within your convention, and you know, they've even passed Law 50, which kind of in the last Olympics was trying to be, I think it's called Law 50, was trying to be used to cut athletes' rights to protest within Olympic venues. You know, so if this is kind of the actions you're taking, I don't necessarily think that this is going to happen anytime soon, but I do think it is necessary because it has to be independent, is my main point. It has to be independent and it has to be universal. And this isn't something that's exclusive to soccer or football. This has to go across all sports, and it has to go like every single level. Like we talk a lot about elite level, but this stuff happens, you know, at semi-pro, it happens within youth. Like we need a cultural change on how we attack this, and we need avenues so that the players can be safe, athletes can be safe.
Yeah, I was going to say that I imagine it's the same area of committee, maybe not the same factions, but they stopped Brazil versus Argentina because of Corona. You know, they ran onto a pitch and stopped.
That was the government, though. That was literally the Brazilian government.
I thought there was an independent aspect to it as well. Maybe I'm getting
no. It was the Brazilian authorities because they said that four of the players had lied on their entry into the country with regards to quarantine restrictions.
Yeah. So, I mean, my point being that things can stop, things can be halted when it's deemed severe enough. So there is areas within some of that they can look at. But I was also going to bring it back to rights. Obviously, contracts in America, and I guess technically the Canadian players would fall under that banner as well, because it's not Canada law, sorry. But, you know, contract rights for a lot of these players as well is so minimal that the fear for bringing anything forward, speaking to the wrong or people, will end in termination, or the worry for that. Like, because, I mean, it's a lot different from the contract areas of football in the UK, and I'm sure lots of Europe, but in the US it seems very like it can be switched and moved at a moment's notice. So there's obviously, as we talked about, players being worried about coming forwards, that surely that should be something that should be looked at as well for job security, irregardless of harassment. Like actual job security for the players, fundamental human rights, as you mentioned earlier.
I just want to pivot to another like solution idea, which is the last thing that I'll put forth. You know, language is so important, and I think that there's so much around that's been improved with this upcoming generation with Gen Z around like the language of consent. And like, if someone wants to hug you, you're like not obligated to give them a hug, and just like, just things around like touching and like your body. And I don't know anybody, you know, you guys both play soccer, Tom, you play soccer, like growing up, coaches were like, if they were showing me a drill, like they would just like touch my body and like move me. And like, there was no like, can I touch you? Just like little things like that. It starts so young where there's just this sort of like understanding that a coach is just like allowed to touch you in certain situations. And like, we need to start, I don't know, putting forth the message that you like can say no to that. I mean,
or yeah, I've seen it also in skiing where I've seen like literally people try to like manipulate like young children, and in skiing it's very technical how to like properly position their body. And I had
under, yeah, it's yeah, under the guise of like athletics, like your body is like your body being a certain weight, your body moving a certain way, that's all under the guise of like performance. And that's something that like Meg Linehan brought up in her most recent podcast. But yeah, I think, like I said, just new sorts of understandings around consent. It's not just about for the women in these positions and the young girls in these positions, but also, you know, with men and whoever, just being educated, it's both of those actors are, you know, having new understandings about like what's okay and what are boundaries and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, I, for the prime example for talking about coaching earlier, the FA level one badge, I did it a little while ago, and it was purely like tactical. Well, not even purely tactical, purely like, here's some drills, we're going to walk you through this this course, like, so you can get into essentially coaching minors as quickly as possible. And the more you think about those kind of words, it's like, that sounds incredibly worrying that, okay, like, that we're doing this course. And it's, and there was, you know, like, wasn't, again, about a little bit about safeguarding, a little bit about trying to recognize abuse from potential abuse from parents or guardians and kids, things like this. But, you know, that still doesn't,
I think this is, again, when we go to like national associations and bodies who are in charge of like kind of training these, I don't think this has been something that's been within their like really on their minds until, I would say that it's probably just coming in recently. Like, their primary motivation when it comes to training coaches is, we need to make sure that they understand what to do to make that whichever athlete they're dealing with is properly trained, and so that they know how to play whatever sport they're doing, and also not injure themselves. I don't think like the things like harassment and abuse has ever really crossed their mind as being something until very recently that needs to be integral, especially if you're dealing with children, to any coaching course. That might be a reason. And again, I think it's because until recently, we really didn't talk about this. Like, this was not something that you openly discussed, or that, you know, in a way, I almost feel like it was like, oh, well, if that happens, that's a criminal matter, and we don't deal with criminal matters. Whereas what's come out with the NWSL and what's come out in a lot of situations, like, it's very rare that the abuse actually crosses the line into an area that's criminal. But it doesn't mean that in any way it is okay. You know, you have coaches who have been in positions where they have abused their power, you know, coercion, you know, sexual, mental, who've been racist, homophobic. That's not necessarily illegal, but again, it is not okay. And this gray area has been allowed to fester in kind, you know, not just in women's sports and like men's sports as well. Like, I used to go watch my cousin play football, and he had one coach that I could not believe the language that came out of this man's mouth. And you're looking around going, how is this acceptable? That's the culture. You know, if you go to any youth hockey game in Canada,
like, youth soccer, a girls' youth soccer, like I coached in Connecticut, and the stuff that people said to the girls, like, the best way to do it is like try to put someone into a classroom. Like, if you took that football coach, was it your cousin or nephew, like if you took that guy and put him in a classroom in front of kids, like I always think about that as sort of like the litmus test. They'd never, ever be allowed. But there's some sort of way that we've allowed coaches to sort of say whatever they want to kids. So I agree. You guys, I actually got to run. Sorry, I didn't
know. Yeah, no. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Yeah, no worries.
Okay, so we're back. Thank you so much to Kira for coming on, talking to us from all the way from Thailand. It is now 2 a.m. my time, which I guess that makes it quarter past nine in both of your areas. So thank you for disrupting your evening plans. We'll talk a little bit more very briefly, player rights, the legality of, from an outside view of what player rights would, you know.
I cannot speak on player rights, honestly.
No, but I mean, the idea of it is this is something that needs to maybe be, you know, for me, from an outside country view, the draft system, which we spoke a little bit about off air just now, is very much set up for men's financial reward. So any of the men's teams that have these drafts and they have these areas, they will get financially compensated at a much higher rate than any of the breakthrough players in NWSL or, you know, other women's soccer or women's football areas. So does that need to be looked at in terms of actual longevity for the women's game in the US?
You mean the draft and trade?
Well, no, I mean, like, as it, so it's, that's not monetarily set up, so you can get moved around, you get moved around, but we're actually in the men's game, it's, it doesn't, you know, you get so much money in the first place that you can be probably set up for whatever area you fall to. You know, these are the professional contracts difference in money for many of those sports.
Well, not is, so I think that the draft and trade system is ubiquitous to North American sports. It's commonplace, but on the men's side as well, there are leagues that exist, like in lower level hockey or even soccer, where you can get traded even though you're not making very much of a salary. But the reality when you my main issue with the fact that a club can own your rights, which is the main thing with drafting and player rights, is that it removes the ability of players to truly decide their future. If a club can just keep them on and decide what is best for them as an athlete, what's best for them as a person. And, you know, in the MWSL, this system wasn't a system that was decided by the athletes. This was a system that was originally imposed kind of upon the athletes by when the first league was originally set up as part of the conditions for getting drafted or for signing up with the league. Like, this is what you have to do. And I think a lot of us are looking with interest at what the outcome of the first bargaining session will be, because the athletes have started in steps for, well, they've been affiliated with the AFL-CIO since, I think, last month, and they've been in bargaining sessions to sign their first ever contract with the league. And I do wonder if this is an aspect that will stay, because my main thing is that when a club is indefinitely allowed to hold on to the rights to a player, and that player may not necessarily have an avenue to go sign elsewhere, it does remove a bit of freedom from that player's career. And if we're going back to the issue of abuse and toxic environments, that, you know, there have been clubs in the NWSL where this has existed. So if you're within it and you don't have a right to go elsewhere, or you get traded into it, there's really no avenue other than to leave the United States. So yeah, I think I'm not a fan at all of the draft and trade system. I understand that it's there within North American sports in general, as an equalizer to try to keep teams competitive, so you don't have really rich franchises that kind of run that finish top six every year, and some that kind of rotate in and out, or in, because we have franchises and there's no relegation, they'd always be bottom of the league. But at the same time, it does kind of remove players' authority anyway.
I was gonna say, well, I mean, I'd imagine that most of the teams, it's kind of obvious, league to league, year to year, season to season, the ones that do better and the ones that don't, based on parts of that.
Well, it's so funny because we call the NWSL the best league in the world, and that's always because of its competitiveness, right? It's like any team can beat any other team on any given day. No, with this whole thing that's happened in the last week, official best league in the world title, it's not, it cannot be placed on it. It doesn't deserve it, that's for sure.
I mean, the like Louisville, for sad example, their first coach of their women's team has left for cause, been fired for cause. That's a bad marker to start with in their inaugural season. And you know, they, and footballing back, you know, merits are, like, they've got, sorry, I've just titled what I was gonna say, footballing merits. They've got a great team by and large, and they've got some, you know, local players, and they've attracted talent from overseas even. And yet the only thing that's going to be now spoke about really is probably that they had to fire their coach halfway through the season, well, towards the end of the season. And that's, and again, it's the sort of the black mark on this league that is overshadowing all of the individual efforts by the players on the field.
Yeah. But like everybody said, this is happening all over the world in women's sport and out of women's sport. But, you know, there's something to be said for, like, you need to talk about it and unearth all this ugly before you can actually move forward. So, yeah, again, I'm just really hopeful for, you know, Megan Rapinoe has used the term, or probably stole the term from someone else, I think, but like, burn it all down. Like, I don't know if it can exist like this, but, you know, there's the whole mythology around the Phoenix, right? Like, we can burn it down, but there will be something that rises again that will be just completely of a different just structure and quality.
Yeah.
With regards to the end of us, like, I hope it doesn't disappear, because there's a lot of, especially players who sacrificed a lot to try to make it viable and get it to this point. But, you know, it's clear that not just for the NWSL, but that, like, players have to be empowered. You know, you highlighted, like, this also comes from a financial side, that there need to be avenues for them to actually report abuse. And historical abuse has to be taken seriously. Just because something happened 10, 20 years ago when there were no avenues to actually disclose it doesn't mean it's any less relevant today. And I also think, like, we touched upon it a lot when we were talking about coaching, like, there needs to be better training of people in charge. And when it comes to leagues, there actually needs to be better hiring policies so that individuals with patterns of behaviors that are troubling don't get hired in the first place. Like, to that, if this happens, like, you cut it off at its root before they are able to enter. You know, obviously it's a system where sports is a system where abuse is more prone to happen because of the power dynamic, but removing those who have abused of that is a necessary first step that we haven't seen yet.
Yeah, 100%. Mm-hmm. Right, let's end it there for the evening.
The person slash morning. Who's supposed to be sleeping in this room fell asleep on the couch because I'm in the room. So
oh no,
we need to cut it.
I'm so sorry.
No, I just got that text a minute ago.
Yeah. Thank you so much for both of your time this evening. Thank you again to Kiara, who came in and chatted away from Timeland. This is what it's half past two in the morning. Words are just like falling out in the weirdest way. I hope anything that I've said has been slightly coherent, or this is just like a weird fever dream.
Always a pleasure, guys.
Nice talking to you again.
Yeah. Thanks everyone for listening.
Thank you. Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.